I am Jim Downing, and if I live to the 22nd, I will be 98 and a half. I'm not using any PowerPoint. I've decided that's the lazy man's way of preparing for a workshop. Because it always moves too fast. You have to take notes. So I like a handout. Now, I made 225 of these. If that's not enough, well, maybe you can share with a neighbor. Because this is my outline. I want to try to follow here. I'm not sure in all my years the difference between a workshop, a seminar, a discussion group, but it looks like in a workshop, why, there should be some work to do. So in this paper, I've got one place for you to place an X. So that'll be your work. No, the evolution of a workshop is the people running the conference ask somebody, will you give a workshop? Yes. Then a few weeks later, what's the subject? Then a few weeks later, give a description. And I find between the time I tell them the subject and the time I develop it, well, some things change in here. So you can help me figure out a title for this, although I will stick to the one that's published on Sin Shall Not Have Dominion Over You, Sin Shall Not Have Mastery. But I want to make sure we're on the same frequency. I've lived alone the last 2 years, trying to learn shortcuts for being my own housekeeper. So I ran across one the other day. This man had a friend that lived up in the mountain with his dog, isolated from all the society. He decided to go up and visit him, so he did. And his friend, the hermit, said, well, you got to stay for lunch. So he set the table, put the plates out, and the guest noticed that there was kind of a little film of grease on it. They're kind of sticky. So as he looked at it, his host saw that he was being kind of critical. He said, well, I can see that you don't like the plates, but he said, it's the best cold water can do. So they went outside, and kind of uneven, and the old man started to stumble a little bit, so he put out his arm to steady him, and when he did, the dog bristled, began to bark, got ready to attack. So the man reached over, began to pet him, and he said, it's okay, Coldwater, he's a friend. So sometimes words are kind of misleading. So I want to start out by defining three words, what I mean by them. And you may mean something else, but then I'll tell you what I mean by them. The first is sin. And I've heard that Isaiah 53:6 is the best description in the Bible of sin. They've turned everyone to his own way. I think that's a pretty good summary. That sin is just turning everyone to his own way. Another word in here is dominion. And I want to call your attention to two verses. And I printed out most of the verses on the second page here. So the first one I want to look at is the second one on the page here, Acts 26, 17 and 18. This is Paul's description of what God told him to do. Now, you notice he didn't say, give them the bridge illustration, or give them the four spiritual laws. He said, I'm sending you to them to open their eyes and turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God. turn from a power of Satan to God, darkness to light. I never understood that until I got acquainted with a Chinese man in Macau, the Portuguese colony north of Hong Kong. And he was stranded without a passport and couldn't leave the country. But he managed to get out. He stopped by to see me. And I said, well, who took over the ministry from you? He said, well, remember I told you about Timothy. Timothy took it over. So I remembered what he had told me about Timothy. They both of these men were from rich families and raised by amas, you know, a servant, kind of substitute mother. So Timothy became a Christian. But his ama was interested in him, so every year she would go to the spirit medium and get an update on him, find out how he's doing. So this one year, she went to the spirit medium, and the spirit said, I couldn't contact him. Can't get any information. So she gave him more money. Well, try again. She went down and said, I can't make contact. When my friend heard about this, he compared this time to when he was converted. And after he became a Christian, why, that's when they couldn't make any more contact. So Colossians 1:13 on the top of the verses here, for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves. You realize that there's more that happens. In fact, according to Spurrier's systematic theology, 33 things happen the minute we become Christians. And one of them is that we're delivered out of the dominion of Satan into the kingdom of light. Do you believe that? In the Navy, I spent 24 years in the Navy. And when the Navy goes into a port, they have a shore patrol, same as military police, and the Marines are Army. And they go around and try to help the guys not get in trouble. If they're misbehaving, send them back to the ship. Well, there's a case I know about that one guy got in trouble about every time he went ashore. So the shore patrol picked him up and sent him back. And then he got discharged. The service. He still frequented the same place. And so the shore patrol, tried to take him back. And he pulled out his discharge. You don't have any authority over me anymore. So after we're delivered out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, Satan can harass. But he doesn't have control. We're not in his dominion anymore. We're in a new dominion. And the third word is perfect. I understand at the time the Bible was translated from Greek into English, the Greek vocabulary was four times the size of English. You can imagine what a problem translators had to try to cram this language into one that only had one-fourth the words. So, the Greek word for perfect is spelled out here in the handout, E-L-E-I-O-N. And in Matthew 5:48, it's translated, be perfect, even as God is perfect. But the same word in Colossians 1:28 is translated, be complete, mature. And other places it's translated other words. But in the 205 times it appears in the Bible, there's never a hint that he's talking about being sinless. So when I use the word perfect, I'm not talking about being sinless, because that's not what the Bible teaches. Now I'm trying to combine these things under one subject. I hope I'm successful. Maybe you can help me on it. But I was in Louisiana State University meeting with some student leaders, and one of them said to me, what's your concept of being a real man. I never been asked that before, and I had to think a little bit. But I hope I came up with the right answer, which was a real man is somebody who is secure in all their relationships. First with God, with himself, family, friends, Christian and non-Christian, and right on down the line. So this word perfect can be mature, be complete. It doesn't mean be sinless. I think we've got plenty of time just to kind of illustrate something on security. So would you guys in the front row number off, you know, like 1, 2, 3, 4, so forth? And then you take 8.
12, 14, 15, 16.
Go through 21. Okay, well, you guys all come over and stand in front of me. How many chapters are there in John? 21. Anybody know?
21.
Now, just in any order you want, I'd like for you to just call out the number that you have so I can hear it and everybody else can hear it. And I will try to tell you what the content is of that chapter in John. Okay, who's first? Chapter 1. That's one of the more difficult ones, but I've named it. John the Baptist introduces Christ, and four men follow him. That's one. You can sit down after you've given your number here.
Chapter
2. 2. 2. You don't necessarily need to do this in order, you know. But 2, the women love 2. That's the wedding at Cana. And Jesus cleansed the temple in 2. So let's get a little variety here, not go down 1 through 21.
5.
That's where Jesus healed the crippled man at the pool of Bethesda.
21.
What?
21.
21. That's what I call breakfast on the beach. Christ had breakfast after post-resurrection fellowship.
15.
15, that's where Jesus said, I'm the vine. And he talked about what it meant to abide in him.
7,
that's one of the more difficult ones. Jesus was teaching at the Feast of Tabernacles early in the feast, and the main content of 7 is teaching on the Holy Spirit.
16?
16, again, is mostly teaching on the Holy Spirit.
9
is the man born blind received his sight.
14
is where Jesus talked about the mansions he had gone to prepare and also about the Holy Spirit in 14.
10?
That's where Jesus said, I'm the good shepherd. And then elaborated on that.
17,
Jesus' all-night prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane.
6,
that's where Jesus said he was the bread of life. He fed the 5,000 and then told people, I'm the bread of life.
11.
That's the great resurrection chapter. Lazarus was brought up from the dead.
4
is Jesus' encounter with a Samaritan woman.
8.
You know, the Feast of Tabernacles, the last night, they didn't have dry cleaning in those days. And the priests wore their garments for a year. And then the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles, they had a bonfire. And that was the highlight of the feast as they burned all these smelly uniforms. So because that was a highlight in chapter 8, Jesus said, I'm the light of the world, and taught on that. Okay?
18
is the betrayal of Jesus, Paul's trial and the betrayal.
20?
Resurrection. Great resurrection chapter.
Three.
Jesus explains the new birth to Nicodemus.
Ten.
The good shepherd. That's where he said he was a good shepherd.
13.
That's when Jesus washed the disciples' feet.
19.
I'm glad we took that last. That's the saddest chapter. That's the crucifixion chapter. I'm a... I'm 98 years old. Now, I've heard that the secret of mastering the Bible is to get your own title for as many chapters as you can. So if you would start and get one chapter every 2 weeks, next year you could do what I did with John. Couldn't you? The qualification for most Christian outreach is to know the Bible. And what you do in John, do for other books. I feel very secure in the Gospel of John. That's what I mean by security. I don't worry about it. Anything in there I can find pretty quick. I didn't do this to put on a show. I put this on to challenge you to start mastering the Bible. And that's the way to do it. Start by getting your own title for as many chapters as possible in that. Okay, so then a real man is one who is mature or complete in all their relationship. Now, the heart of this presentation and the title is, you can meet all of God's expectations. Do you believe that? I would say that one of the greatest hindrances to our effectiveness in outreach is we're not sure how we stand with God. If there's a strain in relationship, it's generally because I'm not sure the other person approves of me. We got to be certain that God approves of us. Everything He wants, we do. We're fully approved. In a husband-wife relationship, wives are so superior to us men that they have a way of making us feel inadequate. And I heard about a husband that had this problem. So he just couldn't please his wife. He just couldn't lead up to her expectations. So he decided he'd stop at the antique shop and buy her a gift. So he found a brass bucket and bought that, took it home. But before he gave it to her, he thought he would clean the mold up a little bit, so he began to rub on it. And when he did, a genie jumped out. And genie said, I'll give you two wishes, and I will decide which one I'll give. Let me know when you're ready with your two wishes. So the man said, well, I've always wanted to go to Honolulu, but I don't like to fly. It takes too long by ship. Would you build a freeway between San Francisco and Honolulu so I can motor out there at my leisure? And the genie said, I understand. What's your second wish? And he said, well, I have a little trouble meeting my wife's expectations. And I've worked on it, tried all I can. I just can't do it. I need some help. And so the genie thought for a minute, said, I understand. And he said, would that be a two-lane or a four-lane? So it's not easy to live up to the expectations sometime of another person. But it is easy to live up to God's expectations. I think we're going to have some time to discuss this a little bit toward the end. But I start out of the five we've got here, five expectations. The first is negative. God does not expect perfection. Sinless perfection, we talk about. That is not an expectation. And when we feel that we're not living up to God's expectations, generally, it's because we're not perfect. We're not sinless. Therefore, I can't live up to His expectations. Heard about the preacher that was preaching on Christ, the only ever perfect person that lived. About a third of the way through his message, the man stood up and said, I beg to differ with you. There was another perfect man besides Christ. And the preacher was a little frustrated. He said, well, I've always been taught this. I've always believed this. You said there's somebody else? Do you know his name? And he said, yes, I know his name. Well, who is it? He said, my wife's first husband. So maybe that's the nearest that ever came for that. But God does not expect perfection in order to meet His expectations. That is not an expectation. I will turn over the back of the handout, and you'll see at the bottom this summary. No word of Scripture sanctions the notion that any Christian ever attains a place where he is not able to sin. That's just God's expectation, that we will fall short. Now, we'll come back and review that in a little bit. But what is God's expectation? Positive. The first one I mentioned, He expects us to use the resources available to not sin. My wife and I had five sons. Our middle son is the nearest to a perfect son that I've ever seen. Never disobeyed, always helpful. You know, he still is today. So one day, he and his two younger brothers were going out to play, and my wife said, now, Joe, don't get your feet wet. But if you do, come in the house immediately. So after the boys had gone out, I said to her, what kind of advice is that? Don't, but if you do. She gave me a good answer. She said, you know Joe, he will use every resource at his disposal to not get his feet wet, but he probably will. And if he does, he'll come in the house immediately. Well, you know what effect that has on us as parents? We didn't love Joe any less because he failed. The fact that he had done all he could to prevent this, that, I think, made us love him more. No, he was that kind of a guy. Well, with that background, I was reading the rest of Psalm 103, and the verse is printed over here in this Psalm 103:14, in the middle of the page. It says, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. And then he goes on, for he knows how we are formed. He remembers that we are dust. The message translates that he knows that we are mud. 73% of the human body is water. If anybody ever tells you you're all wet, you can tell them only 73%, not all wet. I heard a speaker talking about this once. And he said, don't think that God's expectations for a mud ball are all that high. His expectation is that we will use every effort to please him, but he knows that we won't, because he knows we're made out of mud. Let me just add here, can God turn our failure into good? And that's the workshop. It says yes or no. If you have a handout, well, you can fill that in, yes or no. I expect there's be a variety. I won't try to tabulate them right now. But God has a way of doing that. I've visited New Zealand a few times. The population of New Zealand is about 2 million. The sheep population of New Zealand is 80 million. And the Arabs, the only kind of meat they eat is sheep, you know. So every day you see these big shiploads of sheep going to the Arab countries, leaving New Zealand. I visited some of them. My grandfather used to raise sheep. And when the lambs get about 2 or 3 weeks old, they're like a bunch of rebellious kids. They organize in colonies and jump and run and fight each other. And a real mischievous bunch. Then when it comes time for them to obey the shepherd, they don't always do it. In South Africa, I heard that when the shepherd gets one of these unruly lambs, he breaks his leg and then puts a bandage on it, splinting bandage, and then has a special pen, and he carries him every place he goes. Then, so while he's healing, he develops a relationship with the shepherd he didn't have before. So God takes our sin, it seems to me, and treats us kind of like breaking a leg. And while it's curing, well, we develop an intimacy that we would not otherwise develop. There's other ways that he turns bad into good. I started a Bible study 25 years ago among a bunch of Catholic men that never read the Bible. So after about 6 months, I said, now, you guys are not real familiar with the Bible until we started studying it. What is your impression? What's the Bible about? So this one guy, I thought he made a masterful response. He said, it looks to me like the Bible is about God taking what looks like bad and turning into good. Takes a bad situation, makes a good situation out of it. So God has a purpose behind what he's doing. So he can use our failures for our growth and his glory. It doesn't go to waste on that. Now the next expectation is, I want to quote 1 Corinthians 10:13. Tremendous verse. I'll quote in the King James. You may have it in another version. But God says in that verse, there has no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not permit you to be tempted above that you're able to bear. And then, should be in capital letters, but will, with the temptation, also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. I think the translation is a little misleading when it says, with the temptation. So I've always thought that meant, well, when the temptation comes, God will provide a way of escape. But I don't believe that anymore. I'll tell you why and what I do believe. I notice back here at the doors, there's exit signs. Anytime you go in a public building, you'll find an exit sign. Now, when is that exit built in the building? When the fire starts? That's kind of what it indicates in here, you know, well, with the temptation. The exit, the escape, in my estimation, starts in the morning when you get up. You and I can predict with a great deal of certainty what our day is going to be, 90% of it. Now, I speak mostly with college men and women. So I'll tell you what I tell the college guys. You know what your week is going to be like, what class you're going to attend every day of the week, how many people are in it, and day by day. Now, you know that there's certain classes that you attend that there's some girls that are either deliberately or carelessly dress, so they expose more of their bodies than they should. Are you going to sit where you get a good view? Are you going to sit where you don't get a good view? Well, if you plan your way of escape, I'm going to sit behind. You will do it. If you don't plan, fail. We've got certain parts of the city that I live in that I avoid. I'm going downtown. I'll go a few blocks extra just to avoid that. You know, a way of escape, another way we could call it is visualizing. Think about when you plan to come here. You visualized ahead of time when you were going to leave home, the route you were going to take, what you're going to take with you. You know, our lives are pretty much ruled by what we visualize in advance. That's what we carry out, what we visualize. In Genesis 6:5, God brought the first destruction on the world because he said that the imaginations of the thoughts of the heart was only evil continually. So visualization and imagination are about the same. Of the things that rule us, which is the most powerful? It's the imagination. I have a book in which the guy goes into this, and he said, if you're standing on the edge of a cliff and you see yourself falling off, be careful. He said, whenever the will and the imagination or visualization come into conflict, the imagination always wins. That's the strongest factor in our behavior, is what we visualize. So God's way of escape is to visualize ahead of time what we're going to do. I heard about Dale Moody, the evangelist, walking down State Street one day with one of his converts, and he'd frequented most of the bars on State Street. So the barkeeper saw him coming. He took a glass of whiskey and came along the sidewalk right around in the door. He figured once he got a whiff of that, that he had fallen right in. But Amos walked right on past. And the barkeeper came out and said, Amos, you can't go past here without coming and having a drink. And Amos said, you're right. I can't. But Jesus and I can. And we did. So he had visualized before he left home on State Street, when he came to that, he's going to walk right on past. As I'm talking, can you think of some cases where that you have visualized ahead of time, made a plan ahead of time what you're going to do? And that's the one you carry out. So we are most vulnerable to sin when we have not planned or visualized a way of escape. So I believe that's what the verse means, that the way of escape is generally planned in advance. And if we don't plan a way of escape, when the temptation comes, we'll fall into it on that. So God's expectation is that we discover and execute the plan of escape. Proverbs 23:2-3, this in here said, a prudent man sees danger and takes refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it. Some of the other translations say that a prudent man sees and visualizes the way of escape. So this is scriptural. Okay, now the next expectation, we'll summarize these a little bit and talk about them, is what is God's expectation when we fail? What does God expect? This is in 1 John 1 and 2. Listen to this. It reminds me of what I said about Joel. John, writing to the Christians, said, "My little children, I'm writing to this that you sin not. But if you do, just like my wife said to Joe, you know, don't get your feet wet. But if you do, that's just like the Bible. John, don't do it, but if you do." There's a couple of things I want to cover here. I don't know if you ever heard Ron Dunn, inspirational speaker. He comes from this part of the country, I think. I heard him speak once. He said he's a pastor of a church, Baptist church in town. He decided he needed an office in his home. So he got the blueprint drawn up, gave it to a contractor, and they agreed that they'd pay him so much as he got it finished, and then pay him when it was in full when it was completed. Well, the contractor misestimated the cost, and he ran out of money before he finished it. So he told Ron, pay up. And Ron said, "According to the contract, I'll make the final payment when you finish the job. You haven't finished it." But the contractor sued him. So Ron said, "Won't this look good in the newspaper that the local Baptist pastor gets sued for not paying his bills?" He had a lawyer in his congregation, made an appointment with him, explained the situation. The lawyer turned on a tape recorder. And just in telling his story, Ron's ire kind of got up, you know, and he said, "What am I going to do?" And the lawyer said, "I thought you engaged me to be your lawyer." "Did you?" "Yes." "You don't do anything. You won't forget about it. You never have to think about it again. I'll take care of it." So Ron said, "You know, I think it makes you feel good to have a lawyer. So if anybody brings up anything, you can say, 'See my lawyer.'" In 1 John 2:2, he said, "I write to you that you sin not. But if you do, see your lawyer, Jesus Christ." I have a couple of sons that are playwrights, and I'm getting them to help me with dialogue. And one of them is writing up a dialogue of when we've failed, we go into Jesus' presence, see the lawyer, and say, "Well, I did it again. I made a mistake. I failed." And so I think the dialogue, he would probably say, "Well, you acknowledge it was wrong. Is that right?" "Yes, I acknowledge it was wrong. And have you volitionally decided you don't intend to repeat it?" And he said, "Oh, yes, very much." And he said, "Okay, taken care of. Never have to think of it again. Never be brought up again." I heard about the farmer who went to confessional, and he said, "Well, I stole some hay from a neighbor." And the person hearing the confession said, "Be a little more specific. How much did you steal?" And he said, "Well, half a stack." But he said, "Make it a whole stack. I'm going to get the other half tonight." That's not exactly forsaking the intent to appeal. But that's all that the lawyer, our advocate, asks. Did you acknowledge? Did you decide not to do it again? Did you want to? Okay. All taken care of. In fact, I not only took care of it, but I did that for the sins of the whole world in here. Have you ever done a dialogue with this, like this, with Jesus? I think it'd be fun to write out your own. So his expectation when we fail is, see my lawyer, see your lawyer. I think the King James says advocate, but that means lawyer. We got a lawyer. Turn the failure over to. He has already handled it. In Proverbs 28:13, he conceals his sins does not prosper, but whoso confesses and renounces them finds, what is the word here, mercy. That's all God asks. Now, if you believe in justification, you know that justification is more than forgiveness. It's more than God forgetting. It's God saying it never happened in the first place. I was talking to him this Bible study I mentioned with our guys, and I said, if you have a string on your fingers and this represents your life, God goes through, takes every act of failure or disobedience, cuts it out, and splices it together so it doesn't exist. And one of the guys later said, some of us have got a pretty short string. But I heard about the nun came to her priest once and said, the other day while I was reading the Bible and praying, Jesus came in, sat on a chair, and we had a great conversation. And the priest kind of, you know, tried to cover his mouth so it didn't look like he was laughing at her. But it happened again and again. So the priest began to believe her. And he said, if Jesus comes into your room again, I have a request. Will you ask him if he has forgiven the sins of my youth? He was very anxious that it happened again. So sure enough, it did. And he said, did you ask him a question? He said, yes. What did he say? He said, he didn't remember any sins of your youth. That's justification. God only forgives, he forgets. Okay, to take this a step further. After we've had our time with the lawyer, we do everything that we're supposed to do, and then we leave, we still feel bad. I'm going to be pretty brutal here now. I was talking to a man the other day, and he had had a failure. And I said, did you acknowledge it to God that it was a failure? And he said, yes. Did you volitionally decide you don't intend to repeat it? And he said, yes. And you told me that the Holy Spirit is convicting you of your failure. He said, yes. I said, you're a liar. If you met that condition, the Holy Spirit is not convicting you. What makes me feel bad then? Well, most of us are poor losers. And it really hurts our pride to make a mistake. So what we do is sit around and nurse a bruised and wounded ego. So the problem has turned into an ego problem. Hold a pity party for myself on that. So what's the other expectation? And that is that we believe God and not our ego-stimulated feelings. Here, that's God's expectation. When we have met that, done these things, I'll review them in a minute. We have met all of God's expectations. He agree with me on that? Never have to go around feeling whipped or unworthy because they haven't met God's expectations. He does not expect sinless perfection. Now, you have a right to ask, are there consequences of that sin? Well, there may be legal consequences. There may be social consequences. There may be damage to your own health, your body, or mind. And those have to be dealt with. But as far as God is concerned, it's all over when we meet those expectations. I think I told this story at a previous conference. I don't know if it was a workshop or maybe from the platform. But it's so good I want to repeat it. College football game. And near the end of the game, the home team was ahead. And then the other team, the home team tackle, missed the tackle. The visiting team got through and scored pretty near the end of the game. So the tackle who missed the tackle sat on the bench. And of course the coach said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, I made a mistake. I let you down. I let the coach, the team down. I let the fans down. I feel terrible about my mistake, my failure." So he said, "But if you get another chance, I'll do the right thing." And the coach said, "Okay." So when the home team went back on the field, he waved them back. The old tackle just sat on the bench, wouldn't move. And the coach, "Get back here now. I don't feel like it." And the coach said, "Are you sick?" He said, "No, I failed. I need to punish myself for what I did wrong." And the coach said, "Well, who's running this team anyway? I told you, I accept your explanation. Get back in the game." He wouldn't get in the game. So the coach gave him a little lecture. And he said, "I know something about theology and something about psychology. Do you know what's going on while you're sitting on the bench? There's only one thing taking place, and that is your memory is fading." Maybe he's the guy who invented the saying that a clear conscience is generally the result of a poor memory. But if I'm wrong, correct me. What's going on when you sit around and nurse a bruised and wounded ego? Anything going on? The only thing you identify, a fading memory. And then we think it's all right. Well, the trouble is, we have another failure. I heard the definition of pride that I think is the best that I've ever heard. And it was, pride is preoccupation with self. Generally, somebody, Muhammad Ali, "I'm the greatest." You know. If that definition is true, preoccupation with self, which is a greater sin, to be preoccupied with success or with failure? What do you think? It may be that with failure, if so, it's a form of pride. And pride is a sin that God hates. He does not want us to brood over their failure. I told you I was being kind of blunt because I feel strongly about this. For me to think I can do anything to make God forgive me is an insult to Christ. He took care of it. All the Bible students think God's judgment was pretty harsh when Moses, his command to strike the rock and the water came out. He got a little impatient one day and hit it twice. And God said, "Moses, for that you won't go in the promised land." It seems like pretty severe, doesn't it? Well, some theologians conclude that the rock is a type of Christ. He died for our sins. and that's sufficient. Don't add anything to it. So if we think there's something we need to do besides acknowledge and renounce, why, we're seeing what you did something. I've got to do something. Insult, maybe, to what he did. I brought a message to some of our team leaders once at a conference on moral purity. And kind of a maverick in this area, I said, saying, quit doing it. That won't help. If you want me to talk about how to live with occasional failure, I'll talk on that, how to live with failure. So after the meeting was over, one of the leaders came to me and he said, I know what you're talking about. He said, when I was a college student, once, 1 hour after I had engaged in sexual sin, God used me to lead a student to Christ. If I ever write a book on Bible doctrine, it will have two doctrines I've never seen in the book, and they are, God is the God of the present intention. God deals with it according to our present intention. He knows whether we're going to carry it out for 5 minutes, but he deals with according to the present intention. And he is a God of instantaneous restoration. No place in the Bible that I know it said, well, if you acknowledge your sin and then resolve not to do it, why, a couple weeks later, everything will be all right. Or our thinking is, well, after my memory fades and I forget about the incident, I'll be okay again. Now, I've mentioned these five expectations. We've got a few minutes here for you to make a comment or a question if you talk about it. But I want to review these. What did I say the subject was? You can meet all of God's expectations. And perfection, sinless perfection, is not one of them. That's not his expectation. Am I right on that? That's not an expectation. The first expectation is that we utilize the resources we have to try not to, like Job. You know. Then the next expectation is that we plan an escape route. He said, with every temptation, there's a way of escape. We don't have to, but that's when we sin, is when we miss the way of escape or don't plan it. The next expectation was that I talk to the lawyer about it and turn the case over to him. Hey, nothing I can do about this except acknowledge and resolve not to do it again. And then the final expectation is to believe God, not be a victim of my own feelings, ego-bruised feelings, my reverse pride in that. This is very liberating to me. I go back to the coach. And he said, I accept your explanation. Get back in the game. He didn't do it. God says, I accept your explanation. Get back in the battle. I have three vows that I'm trying to live by. I don't live up to them. But the first one is, I will not deny Christ by my silence. Anywhere I am, do something. It's a lot of fun. You know, pick on an airplane, pull out a Bible and start reading it. Or I found there's a way to talk to anybody. Anybody you want to. You don't have to be silent. You don't have to necessarily give them the four spiritual laws or the bridge illustration, but you can bring up a conversation so they know they've been in the presence of somebody that believes the Bible, believes God. The second is, I will not deny him by my conduct when I can't get my own way. I ask college students often, what is your basic philosophy in life? And most of them don't have a clue. And I say, well, let me suggest one. See if you can identify with it. I said, your basic philosophy is, I want what I want when I want it. Get out of my way. And most of them agree that that's their basic philosophy. That's a terrible philosophy. Because when we can't get what we want when we want it, the first reaction is impatience. The next in the chain is frustration. The next thing is anger. The next is violence. And in the case of road rage, murder. Now, I tell you, our reaction when we can't get what we want when we want it can be very damaging to our testimony. I won't deny Christ by my conduct when I can't get what I want when I want it. And the last thing in here is that I won't sit on the bench because of my failure when the coach says, get back in the battle. Here, I'm trying to live up those vows. I don't think this has turned out the way I hoped it would or intended, but what my expectation was that you'd go out of here and feel, hey, it's possible to meet all of God's expectations that He has for me. I don't have to feel inferior. I don't have to feel defeated. I don't need to feel unworthy. I can meet all of His expectations. And I think I'll just take a vote to see how we did. Anybody here besides me that thinks that you can meet, I can meet all of God's expectations? Isn't that liberating? Think we can do that? The reason that we're insecure, as I said, is we're not sure we're meeting the other person's expectations. If we're sure of this, we are a secure person, a real man, in my estimation, a mature man, a complete person. Well, I think that's mostly what I had written down here. Any comment or any question? We've still got 2 or 3 minutes to go here.
Just said this afternoon, we could say, God isn't expecting us to be perfect.
Would you come up here and relay what he's saying through the mic here so everybody can hear it?
Okay, what were you saying again?
Satan has us in a position through sin.
Satan has us in a position through sin where we feel guilty.
But what Jim said today is, we're not expecting to be sinless, perfect. But what we are expected is to meet God's expectations, and that's bad.
Yeah, I don't think everybody can hear that, so say it loud enough everybody can hear. Okay. Maybe get a little closer to the mic here.
Yeah, just come on up here. I'll let you go if you say it.
What I'm suggesting is that when we sin, Satan has us in a position that he wants us. We feel guilty, we feel bad. That's where he wants us. And what Jim said today is we're not expected to be perfect, but we can meet God's expectations by employing strategies against Satan and his schemes.
I'm sure everybody agrees with that. Any other comment or question anybody has? Well, I thank you for coming, and I've got a sign somebody gave me on my refrigerator that said that my age, I don't even buy green bananas. But Hope to see you again next year.